and Poetry. I'm your host, John Ebersole. Today we are joined by the poet Kevin Gooden. His latest book of poems, Upper Level Disturbances, directly challenges modern society in at least one respect. The poems found here are the result of humility, the opposite of boasting, the genuine result of a life earnestly lived. We meet a speaker whose daily experiences, which involve working dangerously or dangerously at rest, seems nearly shorn of his fellow human beings, and in fact often feels that his poems might be the only communication he has with anyone beyond the forest and rivers and beasts that populate his verse. Ultimately, however, Kevin Gooden is a poet who is generously private. His voice is totally singular in expression, but also clearly our own. We might not entirely relate to his physical labor, his actual work, but his spiritual labor and work is undoubtedly ours. But perhaps what is most powerful about these poems, poems haunted by the natural and immaterial world, is that the poet, unlike most of us, is fiercely inner-directed, acting in the world not based on established norms, but moving according to his own morality, calibrated and recalibrated by suffering and grace. Kevin Gooden, welcome to New Books in Poetry.
Well, thank you for letting me be here.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's my pleasure. Before we dive into your work, I just want to, one of the things that struck me when I picked up your book is reading your bio. It is very clear that there are certain things about your biography that matter to you. And you, in fact, seem to want to know, have the reader kind of know certain things about you. And I wanted to kind of peel back some of those layers. For instance, it says you were born in Montana and raised on the Flathead Indian Reservation, where your stepfather and brothers are tribal members. And then, unfortunately, there's a period mark and the biography moves on. And it's like, what? I want to hear more. So I was wondering if you can kind of tell us about your beginnings and tell us about the Flathead Indian Reservation and your family a little bit.
Sure. So I was born in Missoula, Montana, and lived there until I was 4 years old. And my mother and biological father divorced, and my mother remarried and to my stepfather. And shortly thereafter, we moved up to Ronan, Montana, which is on the Flathead Indian Reservation. And my stepfather was a tribal member. And so it was, to me, it seemed natural that life would be that way. Of course, until we would go to, say, Kmart off the reservation, and we would get funny looks from people because my stepfather is very dark, and my mother is dark-haired, and then there's this albino child running around amongst them. So it was interesting that way. It wasn't until I was probably 11 or 12 that a distinction was made for me between students, or I should say friends that were Native and myself. At that time, they did things that white people weren't allowed to do, and so there was a bit of exclusion, I guess you could say.
Yeah, how do you think that kind of distinction growing up kind of impacted you, and did you have lots of questions for your parents on how to navigate kind of this dual cultural world?
It was slightly difficult and a bit troubling for me. I realized that suddenly I was the other.
Mm-hmm.
Where, if we went off the reservation to Missoula or went shopping or something like that, I fit in with people. When I was on the reservation, I didn't fit in so much. But at a certain point, I was okay with that. I realized that I was not a member of the tribe. I would never be a member of the tribe. And at a certain point, I decided that maybe I should go find, quote unquote, my own tribe.
Indeed.
Later on.
Yeah, what did you attended high school in Montana? Is that right?
I did. I went to Ronan High School until the last semester of my senior year, and then I transferred off the reservation to Seely Swan High School, which is a very small logging town. I think it has about 700 people in it.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, when you were kind of struggling with all these feelings of belonging and not belonging, was your family just generally supportive of that struggle, and what was kind of the impact of that struggle on them?
I actually kept it pretty quiet.
You did, yeah.
I did. It was more of an internal situation. I didn't say anything to my mother or my stepfather or my younger brothers. I just dealt with it internally, and until it was time for me to, that I felt it was time for me to leave the reservation.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. And then after high school, you ended up at the University of Montana, is that right?
I did. I took a circuitous route. After high school, I worked for the Forest Service in the town where I graduated, in Seely Lake, Montana. There were just a couple of options for students who graduated there. Mm-hmm. One was the military, one was to go straight into college, and the other was to work in the woods. And so I chose to work in the woods.
Can you tell us a little about that work? It sounds like you walked right into the wilderness.
Well, it was a wilderness, that's for certain. What it originally happened was in 1988, which dates me, there were a lot of fires in Montana, and they began running short of people. And so I stepped up and said, okay, I'll fight fires. And I didn't know if I was going to be strong enough to do it, because I was a pretty skinny kid.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly I found that I loved the work. I loved being able to test myself physically out in the natural world and be in situations of risk.
Yeah, I can.
And also engaging with one very serious element of the earth, of course, a fire, and surviving that.
Definitely.
I think that the adrenaline that produced was something that I became addicted to, because I fought forest fires for 10 seasons.
That's an amazing period of time. And yeah, when you talk about like getting addicted, I was just recently watching a documentary about a war photographer, and they kind of speak of the same thing, that they're kind of drawn back to it, even though they see the hazards and risk involved. At the time you were doing that kind of forestry work, dealing with the fires, did poetry at all play a part in your life at that point, or did that come later?
Well, I had always been scribbling things down, even as a child. But when you're working with men who are fairly rough, I moved up into a kind of a position of leadership. You don't want to be sitting there scribbling down poems when you're leading rough men into a dangerous situation with fire. They're not going to trust you if you say, oh yes, by the way, I write poetry.
I'm glad you really brought up that point, because your poems, you know, and we'll definitely get to them in a minute, but they are undoubtedly tough, and there is a undoubtedly masculine quality about it. And it's interesting that when one is around other men who you would consider like tough, rough, engage the physical world in kind of a very deliberate way, that yeah, the revealing that maybe you like to scribble poems seems like a preposterous thing to share with them. Did anybody at all know you were into that at all, or did you kind of keep this? You know, it's interesting because it's like I think guys in general sometimes have one foot on this kind of tough world, while if you have any sensitivity whatsoever, you're kind of hiding that from the tougher world. Did you? I mean, you just kind of kept that thing, those things to yourself.
I kept it to myself. I didn't tell anybody. you know, when I was in a leadership role, then, you know, you have a walkie-talkie and you're listening to all of this stuff happening on the fire, and you're directing, you know, retard and planes and so forth. I would actually be sitting there making it look like I was writing down information from the fire, and it mm-hmm. would be a snippet of language here and there that would ultimately, in the off season, go into something that could be considered a poem. So
that is fantastic. How did you eventually, after you said 10 seasons of this kind of work, and it must have kind of worked right into your identity, at what point did you say, hey, I'm going to walk away from this?
Well, at a certain point during that time, I had worked on what's called a hotshot crew, which is a fairly elite crew. Mm-hmm. Everybody has to be in really, really super good shape, and the work is more difficult than normal. And I was on that crew for 3 years, and I started thinking, is this really the thing that I want to do with my life? And all indications were that I should. Everybody called me a 20-year man. And mm-hmm. I thought to myself, no, this is more transitory than that. I'm going to move on to something else.
And what did you eventually, is that when you decided to go to school?
Well, I'd been sort of going to school. I started college when I was 21
mm-hmm.
and would go to school here and there. I was sort of on the 6-year plan. And I felt that that's the place where my energy needed to go. So I ultimately said, you know, I'm done. I finished up my undergraduate degree and then applied to graduate school and was accepted at University of Massachusetts.
Yeah, and did you end up applying to a lot of MFA programs? And it's so weird, the stories you're telling about 10 years firefighting to suddenly be in an MFA program. It's interesting. Was that an easy choice for you to choose UMass Amherst, or were you kind of thinking, you know, anywhere all over the map where you wanted to go maybe?
Well, I applied to two places. I applied to the University of Montana
mm-hmm.
and to the University of Massachusetts. And the University of Montana, if I remember correctly, I was going to be given a TA ship. And the University of Massachusetts wasn't going to give me anything. So mm-hmm. I chose University of Massachusetts.
And
actually, that's slightly facetious. Daryl Weyer, who teaches at the University of Massachusetts, actually spent a semester teaching in Montana. And I learned a lot from her, and I felt that maybe that would be a good place for me, because I liked what she taught.
Yeah, how did your poetic sensibility fit in at UMass? Not that UMass has any particular reputation aesthetically, but did you find that your poems fit that community pretty well?
The thing that I really liked about that program was that there was a diversity. They didn't make you write in a particular way. You sort of evolved into your own style or voice, if you want to call it that. That being said, my work was a lot different than other people's.
Mm-hmm. And how long were you in that program?
I started in the fall of 99 and lingered until 2004.
Yep. And what'd you think of, because I've lived in that area as well, as you know, I really, really enjoyed the kind of mix of academic culture with kind of an agrarian, rural landscape. Did you enjoy it out there?
I ended up actually living there for about 10 years.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Oh, wow, I
seem to do things in segments of 10.
Yes.
But I loved it immensely. I felt that that was, of all the places that I had been, that one actually felt more like home.
Yeah, it's where you felt most comfortable in your own skin?
Yeah, and, you know, I felt that that was a place, for me, was a place of great flourishing. I was able to do the things that I wanted to do. And, you know, it was such a vibrant community. You know, you could go hear Tomas Solomon read. You could go and meet people and just sit down and talk about poetry if you wanted, or overhear people all around you talking about literature. And it was just sort of a wonderful community. And then, of course, you could go back, as I did, to the little farm that I lived on and birth lambs after having coffee. So, you know, it was the best of both worlds.
So, you know, the MFA thesis, how did that kind of work into your first book? Because today we're talking about upper level disturbances, which is your third book. How did the MFA impact your first book of poems?
It was the time that I was allowed to spend just living in poetry without having to, you know, deal with other aspects of living. That was such a blessing. And a lot of the poems in the first book were written on that farm in Sunderland that I lived on. Mm. So it was a very important time for me.
Definitely. Definitely. And, you know, I do kind of want to transition over to upper level disturbances, but I'm really curious to hear, how does this book as like a sibling to the other two, how do you kind of view it as, you know, after going through three manuscripts now, do you see a change in your, I don't know, just like how do you compare the books?
Well, the first child is always special.
Mm-hmm.
And each of them are special, but the first one is always the first one. But in upper level disturbances, I think the work begins to, I don't know, I want to say take more risks, maybe, both with subject matter and maybe with language.
Yes, I could definitely see some risk going on there. Your poetry, I don't know if anything is being written. I don't think anybody's writing poems like this at all. I remember what I wanted to ask you is this title. I could be wrong, and I don't think I am, but I didn't, I never saw the title pop up explicitly in any of the poems, but don't tell anybody if that's right or wrong. But can you tell us about the title a little bit? Why upper level disturbances?
I chose upper level disturbances, and it isn't in any of the poems.
Okay. Hey, I said not to say anything. No, but yeah, I didn't see it in there, and that was really curious to me. You know.
Okay. Well, when you're dealing with fire, weather is always an important aspect. You have to keep track of the weather, and when a cold cell comes in over the top of a warm cell, or vice versa, there's danger. There's things that are going to happen that are uncontrollable. And so an upper-level disturbance is sort of one of the situations that you have to watch out for.
Definitely. Definitely.
Because it can, on a fire, it can create, the cold cell can sort of fall in on itself, and that creates what they call a firestorm, and, you know, there's things are waylaid and lost.
Well, I think it's the title was definitely a mystery to me, but I did a little bit of research, but how you described it, I think it's the best description I've heard. Well, I am dying to hear you read some poems and we can discuss some of them. If you could read, I think I'm in love with the first poem of any book of poems because that seems like a big choice for a poet. It's not, you know. So if you could just do us the honor of reading Come Take These Words From Me.
Certainly. Come take these words from me. Once, through my town, there were rivers. Thin trees rippled along the spillways. Morning pierced our breath. Two doves on the rail bobbing their heads. I am my ghost alone. I stand where there is no water, thinking water. The laws of nature determine all the grief one eye can hold. Thistles were his winding sheet, my father. Did he go smooth and gentle? You bum, what cruder diction than moss? Though the great pine shove taproots down and call the black dirt home, though rivers still run, though sickly, through this town, though this town is not my town, I wander. Our saws are sharp and never idle long, and through the day we see the fires and transform the field jumble into lines. Far faces bleared by fire, who are you, that the bright mares of language stride forth their flames? I am never more than this, a green mind in a green world, and yet the kingdoms that come to my ear. I look out and know my place. I, because of love. In this, there is no recourse. In this, I am humble. If seeds be language, let them gather. Let them take these words.
Thanks, Kevin. That was really, really beautiful. And it made me think of how you were talking about taking risk. You know, the pronoun I is just ruthlessly kind of candid in this poem and throughout the book. Was that a particular risk for you to, I mean, there's even some of the language strikes the contemporary ear in a refreshing way, but in ways that I think, I don't know if certain contemporary ears could handle lines, for instance, like that the bright mares of language stride forth, you know, that is so unapologetically beautiful. And also in the poem, not only is the eye very prominent and never in kind of a way that is offensive, but also this idea of a ghost, of a particular absence of a father or of something. Can you talk about that a little with this poem? And it seems to permeate throughout the collection that there's a particular absence going on.
There's actually a few absences. One, of course, is the father figure.
Mm-hmm.
And other people who have been prominent in the speaker's life that have vanished. Friends, people involved in intimate relationships and so forth. So it's that kind of accumulative loss that the speaker throughout these poems is sort of trying to carries that loss with them, and it gets heavier, and then it suddenly, towards the end of the book, it sort of breaks into a real coalescing of that loss into one particular person and one particular incident, I think.
Yeah,
it's as though that the speaker is searching through all of these losses for sort of the beginning of that loss.
That is very, very fascinating. Yeah, and that, you know, and maybe it's just as a result of the physical environment you're around, but you know, the diction, the syntax is always kind of mixing with this more transcendent language. Can you talk real quick about just how the material physical world kind of, how it presents itself to you as something that you interact with? It seems to be just very important to your work, your engagement with the material world.
Well, it's the world that I live on and live in. So it's hard to keep what is around me out of the poems. And when I'm, I guess you could say, writing, I'm usually out walking around. I'm usually out, when I lived in Massachusetts, I would walk the tobacco fields and the pastures and stuff around the house where I lived. And here, which is a very different landscape, I live on the Palouse now, which is basically huge fields of wheat with not much in between them. And so I'm sort of walking out into the landscape here and not even looking for images, but just looking, letting the world enter my eyes and my head and turning itself into language. And when those words sort of stick in my mind, then I'll jot them down on a piece of paper or something in my pocket and take them home and sit down and see if there's anything in those fragments that I wrote down that will work itself into a poem.
Thanks for sharing that that process. I mean, it just feels sort of private when you talk about it. Go ahead.
I guess I don't see a barrier between myself and the physical world, so...
That's interesting that it's not an antagonistic one, that I don't see how it could be antagonistic if you're walking through fields of wheat, I guess, because that just, in a way, there's a lack of busyness to that. There's a, like, I don't know, a serenity to it. I wonder if language is more difficult to apprehend when the landscape is kind of erasing you with its beauty, you know?
Language is always, for me at least, it's ephemeral. You're always trying to catch something that you can't quite catch. And language for me is the only way that I have to catch any essence of that thing that I'm after. And so I try and use whatever means with language, if it's an antiquated diction or a surprising imagery or something. I'm trying to catch that essence that just left the room.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you brought up that you mentioned the antiquated diction. You employ it, you know, several times throughout the collection, and I think that's what I was getting to when sometimes the contemporary ear will hear it and be like, "What?" You know, it's so surprising to encounter in a contemporary book of poems, and yet it has, I think, reached such a when I hear it, it is a novel sound. It's a sound I recognize, but to hear it reintegrated into a contemporary poem is really it's startling to encounter, and it kind of reconnects me as a reader to just a time of poetry that was generated by just some sort of brute human experience. I don't know. But I was wondering if we could turn to another poem.
Sure.
I would love for you to read How the Soil Dampens for the Loss of Thee.
I'm turning my pages. There we are. How the Soil Dampens for the Loss of Thee. My horses do not wander the pasture. The screep of a bird far and hidden in the gray inflections across the landscape. One eye of every beast is closed lightly. Silver lines of slugs on road grit. Some dark shape in the mist, some dread thing emerging, and soon the rain. My horses are not my horses. The barn a borrowed thing from a time I do not remember. The sudden hallucinations of the lost, where every direction becomes home. Some kind of holding pattern that allows me no peace. My horses were never horses, which is the world I have left, the delicate cheekbones of the misbegotten.
Oh, man, thank you so much. You know, I've been spending so much time with your poems leading up to this interview that I was really looking forward to hearing you read these. This poem in particular strikes me with the lines, my horses are not my horses, the barn, a borrowed thing from a time I do not remember. And it reminds me of kind of this, maybe if it's a, I don't know if it's a Christian idea or the idea that, you know, that we're stewards or just kind of temporary managers of the things that will be here long before we're, you know, long after we're gone. Is that kind of maybe how you kind of see the things around you, that you are sort of just lucky to experience it and that you are a steward during your time here?
I tend to think that's often how I feel. You know, we build barns, we buy horses, and oftentimes the horses outlive us. And so, and really, what is ownership? We don't really own anything. We're here for such a short time. So I tend to think that that's the way I feel, that we're, you know, we're here for, what, 70, 80 years?
Mm-hmm.
And that's not that much time.
And yet it's amazing how much energy a lot of us put into the possession of things, and it just makes that word borrowed thing in your poem strike me even more. And another word that came up in this poem that I found throughout, not too heavily, but in some of the other poems, and I think I'm kind of nerding out, I'm kind of being a nerd on your poems here, but I promised myself I would ask you this, is the word dampens. It appears throughout the poems, and dampens is, of course, like, you know, the presence of moisture, but also something that is weakened. And it made me think that the speaker in these poems seemed to just kind of ebb and flow between great vigor and also that the speaker is ultimately put in his place by just certain realities. And that word dampen really stuck with me, that it's something that's weakened. Is there anything you want to say about that word?
Well, I'm trying to think how to put it in a proper way. So after fighting fires for that period of time that I did for 10 years, I actually felt pretty invincible. And it wasn't until later that I started to find out that actually that was not the case, that indeed there had been some damage done to my lungs.
Mm-hmm.
And so to go from the situation of feeling as though one is immortal to a situation where one feels very mortal and maybe the time is not on their side as compared to other people. I would assume that that was, I don't think the choice of that word was conscious.
Right.
But I would assume that that was very much on my mind during the writing of these poems.
Well, thanks for, diving into that. It's always kind of when you've been writing a long time and somebody just suddenly points out, like, it's kind of like pointing out, like, hey, you have some food on your face. Hey, you've been using this word a lot. Tell me about it. It's a little unfair at times because you work so intuitively, you know?
I tend to think that some, well, there's a certain amount of writers write from what they're obsessed with.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, over time, that obsession sort of moves a little bit, sort of fans out. And we keep using those words that help us get further into our obsession. And so dampen seems to be one of those words that I'm obsessed with and I'm slightly repetitive with.
Yeah. Let's move on to another poem, and we're not going to go far because I'm just having you jump one page to page 21. And it is, I don't know if you could say the title is untitled, but you have several poems in the book that are specifically untitled, and yet their subject matter, and they're scattered throughout the book. They don't appear in any sort of sequence. Can you tell us a little about the relationship between those poems? And before you read the one on page 21?
Yeah, I can. My first job in high school was working in a slaughterhouse. It was a small family-run, it was a slaughterhouse and a meat-smoking place. They made smoked hams and so forth and pepperoni sticks. And they also sold prime cuts up in the front. They had a little store. And because I was so young, I was 15 when I started working there. I wasn't able to run the knives or do anything like that. My job was to clean out the gut barrels initially, and to grind up the meat to make sausage and so forth. And I actually enjoyed that work. It was I was just a skinny kid, and I was able to go in and work amongst men.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a job that a lot of people quite smartly would not do, but for some reason I enjoyed doing the work that nobody else could.
I think that's a great introduction to this poem. You can read it anytime.
All right. So, Untitled. I am made of gut barrels steaming in rain, steel hooks swaying the rails as quarters and halves enter the cooler, and the door slams shut, dust from the bone saw weighing the air as blood seeks the lowest place to mingle, to sicken. The smell of blood, bandsaw wheels fresh oiled and torquing, cigarette smoke rising lazy to the lights, blue sockets of shoulders opened, back straps laid bare and set upon scales between jokes, liver, heart, tongue, tripe, and the brains of veal calves thrown to buckets, splashed with brine, the tallow-slicked knives washed, sharpened, and spread across the bench to dry.
Thanks. The last image is really just amazing. And I notice in a lot of the poems, there's saws. There is just kind of what I'm getting a sense from what we've talked about, kind of the work you've done and your poems as well, that there you have been privy to and witness to just a particular amount of kind of moral danger and that there is a violence happening around you in your work, and that it affects even kind of biological bodies in the slaughterhouse, for instance. Can you talk at all about how that being surrounded by those kind of dangers and that violence has kind of sort of impacted your work?
I believe it's impacted, I guess, the way that I engage the world. And indeed, you know, it becomes the subject matter.
Mm-hmm.
It's the world that I know. And you know, the pieces about working in the slaughterhouse, they're vignettes of these memories that sort of smacked me in the face when I was writing this manuscript. They just kept cropping up.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually thought that the manuscript was just going to be a book of slaughterhouse poems.
Wow.
But they stopped, thankfully. But it's I didn't want the poems to have any sort of bias, you know, like saying, oh, this is terrible, horrendous, what's happening to the animals, and so on. I just wanted to be able to witness the work. And I think that's what happens in all of the poems. The poems are poems of witnessing. They see what's going on around them, and they don't shirk away from the violence that is always there in the world.
I think that's a great way to put it. Yeah, the poems, the untitled poems, particularly in the slaughterhouse, I read them many, many times before the thought even occurred to me that if there was some sort of social or political statement being made, because they very just much felt like one was just witnessing back to the reader what was seen, and that imagery never, while the imagery was visceral and sensual in a tough way to read sometimes, it gave the reader, or at least me, a great amount of freedom just to kind of experience it. I want to move on to another poem, Kevin, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Let's go ahead and move on to page 24, where "Soft as When a Body Struck" is found. And you can start that poem whenever you're ready.
Great. "Soft as When a Body Struck." In the overlap of memory and blood, in voices of blood, the clotting, the staunch, flesh shorn from them, in ribbons of musculature smooth and cooling, glossy strands of life anonymous in my hands, backstrap, shoulder cut, this loin and that, in the cartilage of the joints glowing grayly in the day, knuckle and hock, a few hairs stuck to them, in the throat, strange tube lying on the gravel, in the sockets, in the eyes of the sockets, that burst at the touch of a blade, drain down a face, and over the fingers that touch you now, when you twitch, dreaming.
Thank you so much for that. And it gets back to that. You know, your poem's just like, in, I guess, a sort of compelling way, you know, remind me of that I am just this body that can be hurt. It bleeds, it leaks, it can be damaged easily. And I think what is so great about your poems is they seem to be always wrestling with the fundamental conundrum of being a human being, that we have these vast interior lives, that we have dreams, hopes, loves, and never mind our engagement with language as poets. And yet your poems, which are, you know, the artistic expression, are simultaneously showing that interior amazement while describing and reminding the reader that you are just a material, that, you know, when we pass, what is the body? And I think that's really this two-pronged thing your poems do, is that they celebrate our interior life while ruthlessly reminding us that it is that we are on borrowed time to experience that. Let me have you, if you don't mind, turn to page 34.
Sure.
Where you have a sequence of poems that are titled "Album," and when I read that title, I thought of, you know, photo albums, and then I thought of, I don't know, musical albums. Do you want to say anything about the title at all? Like, how'd you conceive these poems? Like, how did you see this album?
Well, I saw it as just a collection of things that I remembered from living in a few different places, like Montana and Massachusetts,
mm-hmm.
and Lewiston, Idaho, actually, where I lived for a year before I moved out into the country.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, it's just an album of movements, maybe.
Yeah, I really like it. So this is number 7 in the sequence.
Okay. Wind unsoils the field, and still we persist not knowing what comes next, hunting for some fissure between words where we, for a time, can remain. The corn cribs are empty, and my light is not yet finished, but altered, like snow that falls at 4 in the morning and snow that falls at freezing. And yet to stand abraded within, though the beasts gather at the sound I make up to bring them to fodder, as fields ripple and scarify, as the words hover above our ground, you and I in the redemptive dark.
Thanks, Kevin. I wanted to ask you, you know, and some of the description on the back of your book kind of gets to this idea of, and of the transcendent or the sublime, and there are mentions of kind of this idea of God. How do you kind of conceive of that? That I mean, it sounds like a horribly complex question. Like, hey, what do you think of God? But how does there seems to be at least an acknowledgement that there's at least a suspicion that there is something going on beyond maybe our 5 senses. But I could be wrong. I just wonder if you could speak to that.
Yeah, I do think for me personally. Growing up the way that I did, and my mother and stepfather are very devout, strict Catholics,
mm-hmm.
and I for a time was, but I have greatly lapsed. Mm-hmm. But I think having that knowledge that belief that God is tangible. God is in the world. That it's like the world is made of God. You know, mm-hmm. God is woven through everything in the world, and there's glimpses of that in the poems, and I think that's why the imagery that I use in the poems, to me, it feels as though when I write those things down, the things that I see. That there's, just by having those words and the weight of those images stacked together, that at some point it's sort of the poem that I'm working on will sort of break into, I guess one could call it an epiphany or a revelation of something beyond what is here. And I think ultimately, you know, people use the term the other for the thing that they're trying to encapsulate, and I think that's I tend to use the word God.
Exactly.
Others would use the word other or some other phrase, but I like to use that term because it's so weighted, it's so with both good and bad things, that the poem has to be structured in such a way that the term God can be in the poem without it collapsing.
No, I totally agree, and I'm very sympathetic to your view of things, for sure. And it's interesting that you kind of, that the echo of Catholicism is there. Because often, you know, if one thinks of just the stories in the Gospels, that they are some of the most ruthless, realistic stories about human nature that I've ever encountered. And I don't see how anyone sees it otherwise. If you could turn to page 41 for another poem in the family of the untitled.
Sure. This is, again, untitled. There is a light, you say, that shines out from inside. As I remember quartered hunks, I lifted gambrel to gambrel in the slaughterhouse of my youth. How pale tallow soaked the hands, stenched them beneath lethargic vacillations of frigid fluorescent lights, the change in twang of bandsaw arcing through bone, or the crack of a hatchet cleaving the joint, suck of synovial draining brightly to the floor, or steam of hacksaws raking down spines, and the breath of men, language of men, the reek and steel and passing of time.
Thank you so much for that. Your poems always, they always, the violence in them that they're, that is described, I mean, it's really just trauma to a thing, though the thing is altered by a trauma, and it always feels like the poems, and I think your language is, at least for me, always trying to crack open what is not, that what is invisible, that somehow if, that there can be a rupture in the physical to hopefully reveal the immaterial. And but alas, who knows if that happens. And you said earlier, like, maybe we can catch a glimpse of it sometimes when, if we look hard enough. I want to turn now to the final poem in the book on page 49, which is called Listening to Arvo Part's Fioralina. And if you could, there seems to be clearly some sort of narrative background to this poem. If you could talk about that for a moment.
Sure. So the poem is dedicated to Joe Grady. He was shot in a bar fight by Brent Brown in Hungry Horse, Montana in 1997. Joe Grady and I grew up together. He had a pretty rough life. His mother abandoned both him and his father when Joe was 6 weeks old, and so his father raised him. And his father worked at the mill, and he worked second shift. And you know, I met Joe in kindergarten, and his father was never home when he got home from school. His father was always working, and so he was left to his own devices to entertain himself. And I was often brought along on his escapades. But at a certain point, things between him and I became complicated and fraught with peril. And he called to get a hold of me one time, and I decided not to call him back.
Mm-hmm.
And we all make decisions with people that we deal with, and whether to engage them or not at that particular time. And I don't know if my talking to Joe Grady would have changed the outcome of things. I highly doubt it. But one is left with, or at least I am left with the remorse of not talking to him the final time. And so years on after this happened, and I was listening to Arvo Part's Fioralina, and it's a very simplistic piece of music. It's the piece of music where he discovered his, what he called his tintinnabuli. And basically it's a note cluster of three notes sort of written on an aleatoric line through this piece of music. And anyway, I sort of had a situation where I was confronted again with Joe Grady. So this is the piece. Listening to Arvo Part's Fioralina. In the music, it is winter, and you have walked far. The heels of your hand-me-down boots taped up, hands raw and calloused by lumber. In the music, it's winter. Chill of the breathed-in air. I look for Polestar, but see only lies. You trying to close the red flower blooming from your chest, shamed by my implication. Music, winter, the white and bitumens of winter. You stand near me now and do not look away. The yellow buck teeth, dark hair cut in a slant above your eyes. The powder burns, the small hole, I need not touch to know. We are here now, within the music, within winter. You, who called for me, and I, who chose not to save you.
That was really amazing, Kevin. It was heartbreaking. And it's, your work is sometimes described not to be populated by other human beings. And that might be true, but when they do enter your poems, I think you treat them in a humane and gorgeous way. That was really great. We're slowly getting to the end of our time. I was wondering if you would like to read any, like a new poem you might have laying around.
Sure. I have one that I wrote, well, probably a week ago or so. It's called Furl, and it may be still rough, but we will see. Furl. What will be relinquished? Whose small hand will you let slip from yours before it is time? 8:13 a.m., and the fields are greening there where the blackbirds gather, a bright blood thickening, ripples of a web, dust motes on it, scrims of pollinated air, all tractors of a spring billowing a black surge the silo wavers into, fusty dawn, were little dying things of night, vague and haunt with many birds, a few birds, the none, where a line waits to be drawn, evaporative hour, rabbit hour, hawk, hawk's beak, hawk's bane, what flees a shadow but holds a harm, the give, the granted, the want as you live, the catch it all, the hold it all, the breathe it all home.
Thanks, Kevin. That was, again, incredible. I think your work is just keeps getting better. It keeps growing. And every poem that you've been writing is just, there's that, and it kind of goes back to what you said about facing the fires for those 10 seasons, that you were totally always confronted with risk. And it is exactly that risk, that something's at stake, that is reflected in your poems. And I know a lot of poets wish they could say that about more of their poems. That's all the time we have, and I just want to thank you so much for joining me. It's really been a pleasure.
Well, thank you, and I'm honored to be interviewed.
All right, Kevin, thank you.
Thank you.